jury selection is set to begin today in the long-awaited corruption trial of former Ohio House Speaker Larry Householder. It's been 2.5 years since an FBI raid made public the federal bribery investigation into the passage of House Bill 6, the nuclear bailout bill. Householder and his co-defendant, former Ohio Republican Party Chairman Matt Borges, insist they did nothing wrong. Two others accused in the scandal, both of whom pleaded guilty, are expected to testify. Welcome to the Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable. I'm Mike McIntyre. Andy Chow of our Statehouse News Bureau is covering the trial, which is expected to last 6 weeks, and he'll start the show with us today to talk about what we might expect. Also on our list, an ethics bill meant to increase transparency in state government and increase confidence in elected leaders is introduced in the House. And the screen goes dark in three local movie theaters. What do the closings say about how the pandemic has changed our entertainment habits? Get your popcorn and Twizzlers. The show starts right after this news. It's the Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Mike McIntyre. Thank you so much for joining us. Jury selection is set to begin today in Cincinnati as the corruption trial of former Ohio House Speaker Larry Householder and former Ohio Republican Party Chairman Matt Borges begins. Arguments are expected to begin Monday. The Ohio Attorney General says it may be early April before a grand jury will be convened to hear the case against Akron police officers in the shooting death of Jaylen Walker last summer. And he said that's an even tenuous date. It may be even later. Derek Marin, the state representative from Toledo, who expected to be House Speaker and says he's still the leader of House Republicans, has introduced a bill aimed at increasing transparency and confidence in state House leaders. And a string of movie theater closings this week in Northeast Ohio signals the enormous impact the pandemic has had on our entertainment habits. Joining me to discuss this week's news from IdeaStream Public Media, reporter Gabriel Kramer. Hello there, Gabriel.
Happy Friday, Mike.
Happy Friday to you. From the Buckeye Flame, editor Ken Schneck is back with us. Hey, Ken.
Happy 2023, Mike.
Oh, wow.
It's my first time here.
Okay, good.
Nice.
So it keeps going.
Yeah.
I wonder when is the cutoff for Happy New Year?
It was this morning.
Okay.
Just happened.
It's my favorite holiday, so I'll be saying it until March or April.
Okay, perfect. And in Columbus, Karen Kassler, Ohio Public Radio and Television Statehouse News Bureau Chief. Happy New Year to you, Karen.
Hey there. Glad to be here.
We don't take calls on the Friday Roundtable. We do, though, seek your comments and feedback and questions via email and Twitter. So shoot us an email now, soi@ideastream.org. I see that's already started before the show even began. So soi@ideastream.org is a way to get through to us. And you can also tweet at Sound of Ideas. All right, let's get ready to Roundtable. Jury selection is scheduled to begin today in Cincinnati in the trial of former Ohio House Speaker Larry Householder. He's being tried along with Ohio Republican Party Chairman Matt Borges. Both face federal racketeering charges tied to the passage of HB 6. That's the wide-ranging energy bill that included a $1 billion buyout for two nuclear power plants owned by First Energy Solutions. Prosecutors allege Householder and his associates accepted more than $60 million in bribes from First Energy to muscle through the nuclear bailout bill and to help put Householder back in power at the State House. Householder and Borges have maintained their innocence throughout the investigation. Two others who pleaded guilty are scheduled to testify. First Energy signed a deferred prosecution agreement in July of 2021 and agreed to pay a $230 million penalty. Statehouse News Bureau news editor Andy Chow will be in the courtroom starting next week to cover the trial for all the public media organizations that make up the Ohio newsroom, including us. So he joins us now for a few minutes to lay out what we can expect. Good morning, Andy.
Hey, good morning, Mike.
Good to have you with us. Householder all along has claimed there was no wrongdoing here. This is just politics. Prosecutors need to prove otherwise. But basically, the argument is it's, you know, when we talk about the sausage making of politics, it's gross, it's ugly, it's disgusting. But he's saying not illegal.
Right. In the few public statements that Larry Householder has made since his arrest, that includes appearing before a House committee fighting against his future expulsion and then appearing on the House floor once again, fighting against an attempt to expel him, which did succeed and he was expelled from the House. Larry Householder would be brief in his comments, but basically make the argument that what he did was not illegal, but what he did was something where he believed in legislation that he thought should pass anyway, and that he was just paid by special interest groups who believed the same thing he already believed. Now, what we know through many different avenues, such as a deferred prosecution from First Energy and from plea deals from other co-defendants, is that that is not the case, and that instead millions and millions of dollars flowed through dark money groups into a 501c4 allegedly operated by Larry Householder in order for him to rise up through the ranks to take power from the Ohio House, to become House Speaker, to help his allies become elected, and then in return pass HB 6, that nuclear power plant bailout bill.
This really was an amazing thing. He had left the speakership and left the House, I think, in 2004, then had returned, and to ascend to the highest towers of power there, people would wonder how that might happen. What the prosecutors will allege is it was money.
Well, and part of the story goes from federal prosecutors and investigators is that he was sitting around in 2016 and made a deal with certain people in his quote-unquote enterprise to say, hey, I'm not only going to return to the Ohio House again, but I have this scheme in place to take over power. Now, remember, at that time, there was a certain hierarchy of people already in the Ohio House that people assumed would rise up through the ranks to become House Speaker. At the time, Cliff Rosenberger was thought to soon become House Speaker, and then Ryan Smith. Cliff Rosenberger ended up leaving for another alleged scandal, and then Ryan Smith was the one who took over, representing more of the majority of the House Republicans. So the fact that Householder was able to come back to the state house and then individually on his own, using his own political coffers, support his own allies in Republican primaries to end up winning and come to the House and vote for him as Speaker instead.
Hmm. Karen, let's step back. We mentioned two other defendants who may testify here. There actually were a total of five at the very beginning. Can we just step back and say, besides Householder and Borges, who are the players here?
Well, we've got lobbyist Juan Cespedes and also Householder political strategist Jeff Longstreth. They have both pleaded guilty. Also involved here, Andy mentioned First Energy. They agreed to a deferred prosecution agreement, essentially a plea deal with a $230 million fine, and agreed to cooperate in that plea deal. They admitted that they bribed two public officials, Larry Householder and former PUCO, Public Utilities Commission of Ohio Chair Sam Randazzo. He has not been charged. His house was searched by the FBI in November of 2020, and he resigned. But again, he has not been charged. The other lobbyist who was charged in this case, Neil Clark, died by suicide in March of 2020. There's also a 501c4 called Generation Now, which is the group, the nonprofit that the money was moving through. The organizers of that have also admitted guilt. So the only people remaining here, really, at least in the initial case, are Householder and Borges. But former U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of Ohio, David DeVillers, who actually filed this case, has hinted that there might be others. You know, he's not working on the case anymore, but he said the case is not over, that the investigation continues.
Andy, I recall that Dave Greenspan, former representative from here in Northeast Ohio, was a player in this in terms of texts that were sent to him from Larry Householder. Is he expected to testify, and who else might we see on the stand?
So when you read through the trial brief and what the prosecutors plan to do to make their case in this trial, they talk about the information that they gathered along the way, along their investigation, and that includes the information from Representative Dave Greenspan, who was known as, I believe it was Representative 7 in the affidavit. He was this unnamed representative that went to federal officials and said, hey, something shady's happening. You should take a look at this. There's also undercover agents, and that's where Neil Clark seemed to have become involved here, is that undercover agents, according to the trial brief, had recorded conversations with Neil Clark, and allegedly Neil Clark said things like, hey, if you want to get a deal done, you can go through me, we can go through Generation Now, there is a way to make this happen. And it seems like a lot of the case can rely on these undercover recordings from these agents.
And when you say Generation Now, earlier you mentioned dark money. Generation Now is known as a dark money organization. What does that mean?
So this is a organization that can file as a 501c4 and does not need to reveal where the money is coming from. It needs to follow certain rules as far as political campaigning and tax exemption, stuff like that. But basically what we saw through Generation Now was this political effort, this this marketing effort to put pressure on lawmakers to pass HB6. And that's where Dave Greenspan comes in and other Republican representatives who didn't like the way things were being handled when HB6 was moving through the Ohio House, is that these lawmakers who were on the fence all of a sudden started seeing mailers and commercials being played in their own districts, calling on constituents to reach out to these lawmakers who are on the fence and tell them to vote for HB6. And all of a sudden, these lawmakers are like, hey, what's going on here? Who's this generation now? Who's pulling the strings of all of this? Then you flash back a year later to find out that federal investigators say, well, Larry Householder, their own House Speaker, was the one pulling the strings to apply pressure through Generation Now.
What's the status today of HB6?
Well, HB6 was a big comprehensive bill. It bailed out nuclear power plants in Ohio. It subsidized a coal plant in Ohio and another coal plant in Indiana, and it wiped out Ohio's green energy standards. The nuclear part of that has been repealed in a couple of different ways, mostly because the nuclear power plants, the new owners of those plants, decided that they didn't need the subsidies anyway, and they went through a different way to get the money instead. The coal subsidies are still there. That was propped up through a provision that allowed for a charge of up to $1.50 on everybody's electric bills to subsidize these two coal plants. And the elimination of the green energy standards is still in place. And that was a huge hit to environmentalists and other advanced energy groups who believe that Ohio's green energy standards, these rules that helped incentivize things like wind, solar, and other alternative energy sources, that has gone by the wayside too. So a lot of impacts still remain through the ripple effects of HB6.
We often see a long stretch of time between an indictment and a trial, but 2.5 years seems long by any standard. What are your thoughts on the length of time that it's taken, what's been happening in the meanwhile, and what does that portend for how long this trial is expected to last?
So there's a couple of things here. This has been called the largest corruption scandal in Ohio history. And I think when you look at the case, prosecutors really want to make sure that they get it right. Because like you said, Mike, not only has it been a long time since the arrest to this trial, but there have been millions of documents of evidence being poured into the case. Trial lawyers on both sides have said, hey, we need more time to look over all the evidence against us. And on top of that, I think another surprising thing is that we have not seen any other indictments come down. We heard from agents and from prosecutors that more could happen, but that never happened. So who have the prosecutors been talking to? Who's going to take the stand? I think it's going to be really interesting to see what happens next, because we could start seeing more of the missing puzzle pieces come into place to make a clearer picture of what's going on here.
Andy, appreciate your time with us. Go ahead and get on back to work. We're going to let Karen carry the rest of the State House news for us today. Thanks so much for being with us.
Sounds good. Happy Lunar New Year, too.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Never, never not the right time to say some sort of Happy New Year.
Can I add one thing
here,
too?
Please do. Yeah, I was going to transition to that. Yep.
Yeah. House Bill 6. I mean, this was, as Andy just mentioned, a sweeping energy law that did all sorts of things. And for a long time, we kept hearing about how this was good for Ohio's energy portfolio. I mean, Governor DeWine talked about how that's why he was going to sign it, because Ohio needed the nuclear power plants to keep going. The judge in this case has made it clear that he is not going to tolerate a defense of House Bill 6 as Larry Householder's defense. This trial is not about House Bill 6 and whether it was good or bad legislation. That this is about the charges against Larry Householder. So I think that that's an interesting thing to note, that while House Bill 6 has been changed in many ways, there are people who still defend it as a good piece of legislation, and Larry Householder is one of them.
Let's talk about another piece of legislation just introduced this week that might have some connection to this. The state representative who lost out on the House Speaker vote, still maintains he leads House Republicans, wants to improve transparency and ethics laws at the State House. Derek Marin, who's the Republican from the Toledo area, introduced a bill that will require lobbyists to report all income they make from clients and prevent public elected officials from serving on corporate boards. Marin says trust and integrity are crucial for people to have confidence in their government. Is this tied in any way to this whole scandal?
Well, he was asked that. He had this press conference where he was flanked by some of his supporters, and that question was brought up. And he said, no, this is about transparency in government, and that he was going to propose this. If he had become speaker, it would have been House Bill 1 under his speakership if he had become speaker like he was expecting to be. So I think it is interesting, though. One of his supporters stepped to the microphone then and said, hey, we've got a problem here among Republicans. This was a Republican-involved scandal, and we, as he referred to his group, the Integrity Caucus, are going to fix this. Now, the question is, of course, will some of these proposals go through? There are five different parts of the bill. You just mentioned two of them, and some of them are kind of a little bit more inside baseball, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But you got Democrats who say, hey, we've tried to do this before, and it's gone nowhere. That's going to be the question. Is it going to actually move this time? Are there going to be ways that we get more transparency in government and be able to see some of these things as they're happening?
So perhaps the Democrats who supported Jason Stevens for speaker might also then say, wait a minute, we've been wanting to do this for a while, so now we're going to go ahead and jump over and support Derek Marin on this issue. And then you've got, I don't know, chaos.
Well, and that's a really good question. The Democrats are the super minority here, but they do have a voice. And it's really interesting to watch all of this happening. But of course, nothing can happen until the House actually gets its rules set and makes committee assignments and all that stuff that hasn't happened yet. There's a session next week. And these folks who back Derek Marin say they want to change some of these rules. They say two-thirds of Republicans back Derek Marin. Those people should get two-thirds of committee chairmanships and committee seats on those committees. And we haven't heard anything from Speaker Stevens yet on this, but that would be really interesting for him to award two-thirds of committee chairmanships to people who voted against him, essentially.
I said chaos. I could also just use the word politics, Ken.
No, he actually said, Marin said at one point, one of his quotes was, we are under siege. There's no question about it, but we will stand our ground. You said it twice, Mike, and I can't get past the sentence of the state representative who lost out on the House Speaker vote, who also has the quote, and this is the actual quote, I'm the leader of the House Republicans.
Right.
That's a remarkable sentence to put those two things together. So some real fracturing there, yeah.
Let's talk about the householder case and House Bill 6 investigation heads to trial. Another energy policy decision by lawmakers in Columbus is being scrutinized. We discussed here on previous shows the passage of a bill that was signed by the governor and makes it easier to drill for oil and gas on state-owned lands, including state parks. Bill also labeled natural gas as a green energy, and it turns out there was a lot of dark money from the natural gas industry spent convincing lawmakers and the governor to declare that methane gas, a fossil fuel, is a clean energy like solar and wind. Karen, reporting from Cleveland.com, details the heavy involvement of a dark money group linked to the natural gas industry driving this legislation.
Yeah, and the Washington Post also reviewed some documents showing two groups, the Empowerment Alliance, which is a dark money group that has ties to the natural gas industry, and also the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, which a lot of political watchers are familiar with, is a conservative group of lawmakers, businesses, other donors who fund it anonymously. Those two groups were involved. And, of course, ALEC is where often Republican lawmakers get model legislation that they take home and pass in the states, and that's apparently what happened here. And Republicans say that this was about promoting Ohio's natural gas industry, that gas is cleaner than coal, and that's true. You might also remember the shale gas boom that Republican former Governor John Kasich used to talk about a lot. But natural gas is not green energy. It has a higher methane footprint. It's not green energy, and that's a really important thing to note here, that this law does change that language, but it's not green energy.
All right, let's just call the color the color. It's green, right? So we're talking about money. Ken, it seems ridiculous that you would call a fossil fuel a green energy, and the only motivating factor for that would be to try to get people to use more of that fossil fuel. Obviously, that would be what drives the dark money group. Our political leaders bought it.
it's the money, right? That's the money piece, and it's where verbiage really can, well, we can convince people if we use the language. My best friend is an environmental scientist, and when I'm feeling like a troublemaker, which is often, I just yell clean coal at her, and she gets so angry, and it's just fun to watch. But yeah, it's not a green energy, but if we call it that, then people will sign on to it. So all we're really doing is calling it that. And when some politicians have been asked about this, their response is, well, it's greener energy, right? It's greener than coal and oil, but as Karen said, it emits about 50% less carbon dioxide, but it releases methane, which does so many more harmful effects.
And the question then is, if you're calling that green energy, then what does that do to the pursuit of other things that are actually renewable energies, which is what many would define as green energies, such as wind and solar?
So much of this is getting the public to sign on to it, and we know at this point that calling it green energy does get people involved. And so, yeah, it does hamper folks embracing and investing money, right? That's the key piece. We have to invest money in solar and wind, and you can't do that if people think, oh, well, we found the solution. It's not renewable.
It's reminiscent to something we'll be talking about later in the show, where lawmakers are trying to pull a fast one on people. And, you know, it's certainly deceiving.
Let's talk about another environmental issue, and that is the Northeast Ohio Area-Wide Coordinating Agency is pushing on with the development of a regional plan to address climate change. By the way, something that is exacerbated by the burning of fossil fuel.
Right.
And despite pushback and disruptions at listening sessions earlier this month by climate change deniers, the organization held simultaneous sessions on January 10th where attendees could participate remotely by watching on YouTube or in person at one of five locations in counties within NOAACA's coverage area. That's Cuyahoga, Geauga, Lake, Lorain, and Medina counties. NOAACA says the Climate Action Plan aims to reduce carbon emissions in the region to support the national goal of net zero carbon emissions by 2050. Gabe, NOAACA says its data shows 80% of Northeast Ohioans believe that climate change is a thing, that it's bad, that they want more action, but the remaining 20% is vocal, and that's what disrupted their meetings.
Right. And before I dive in a little bit, I want to point out when you mention all these counties and the broad reach that NOAACA has, you're talking about a pretty diverse area. You're talking about urban, suburban, rural areas. So you're going to have people with trains of thought all over the spectrum. This meeting, which, as you mentioned, was held in one location, had four other locations where people attend, but you could also attend remotely on YouTube. So there was this third-party service used so that people could chime in and leave comments. And a lot of those comments kind of maybe weren't so civil. Maybe those comments derailed from the conversation and were taking shots at NOAACA. And, you know, people definitely had a chance to say their piece, even from like a text message type of situation.
There are members of the Tea Party in Geauga County who say we're going to be back at the next session, too.
And they're at a board meeting at this moment. I mean, there's a NOAACA board meeting happening right now, and they had an effort to, you know, encourage people to come out. And, you know, NOAACA's response to the Geauga County Tea Party in general is, you know, we're not going to let them derail this conversation. You know, essentially, they feel as though it's almost just outside noise and it's not productive by any means.
Ken, your best friend, the environmentalist, probably also gets frustrated when you talk about the fact that there are some solutions to some of the problems, such as use more public transportation, don't drive as much, all kinds of alternatives. And yet people writ large say, I don't want to be told what to do.
Right. We as someone who teaches change theory, that's part of what I teach at Baldwin Wallace, we humans don't like change generally, especially if we can't predict how it's going to affect our day-to-day life. And so it's not enough to just provide these solutions of taking public transportation more. Look, I would actually love to take public transportation more than I do, but there are certain places I can't get to at a certain time.
Maybe better public transit.
Exactly. And so it's really explaining the methodology of how this is going to affect your day-to-day life, which includes various different costs, including the cost of being late. Just that day-to-day piece, folks can't embrace change without it.
It's interesting, too, how the arguments then get to a point where they become absurd. And I think about last week when we heard about gas stoves and the comments about how eventually homes, are like cars, are going to have to become places that are powered by electricity and not necessarily by gas because there's a broad problem if every house is powered that way. And suddenly it became folks saying they're coming to your houses to take your gas stoves.
Okay, not just folks. Representative Jim Jordan had a tweet out that made it sound like Braveheart. They're coming for your freedom. They're coming for your gas stoves. So I think your earlier point there of politicians playing a role in this rhetoric is a really important one because there's so much funding coming in from, going right back, natural gas companies, companies that are invested in these changes not happening. So it's you're affecting my day-to-day life, and I don't understand why. I don't understand how, and I don't understand what tomorrow is going to look like. If you can't answer those questions, no one's going to embrace change.
Also, what about China? I mean, you'll get that. Okay, well, if I stop burning my stove, their stoves are going, and so you eventually don't get to a point where any progress is made.
Exactly.
Can I add something really quick?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. This morning on Morning Edition, there was a great piece on how that whole gas stove thing became a right-wing conspiracy theory. So I just wanted to promote that if people are – okay. If you missed Morning Edition or
I did hear it today. That's why it was on my mind. Yeah. By the way, I think you're a little off mic. Something happened.
Oh, here I am.
There you are.
Okay. Welcome back. Happy New Year, Karen.
Were you over at the stove? Is that what you were doing?
Multitasking.
Gabe.
I just wanted to point out that for some of these people, it's not even just – it's gotten so far that it's no longer a willingness to embrace change or understand that why this change needs to happen. But for some people, they don't want to be heard at all. And that's a big factor for the disruptions at these NOAACA meetings.
All right. We'll take a quick break right here. It's a good spot to take a break. I'll give you a little bit of feedback, though, on what we've been talking about. Pat sends us an email and says – those ubiquitous dark money organizations need to be outlawed. And then she says, fat chance in this climate. And John says, where was the Ohio Consumers Council during the scandal over HB6? Didn't the council, who is supposed to look out for ratepayers, see problems occurring during this whole fiasco? So when we come back from the break, let's get a thought from Karen on that. We'll move on to the rest of our topics on the roundtable today. It's The Sound of Ideas. I'm Mike McIntyre. Stay tuned. You are back with the Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Mike McIntyre, joined this week by Ken Schneck from the Buckeye Flame, Karen Kassler from our State House News Bureau, and Gabriel Kramer right here from the main office here at IdeaStream Public Media. Karen, I asked that question from John just before we came to the break. Has that been asked or looked into, the Ohio Consumers Council and its role in HB6?
Oh, absolutely. The Consumers Council wasn't as involved in House Bill 6 as it made its way through the legislature because the office had been cut. I mean, the budget had cut the Consumers Council dramatically. But then after House Bill 6 passed and then all of this scandal erupted and everything, that Ohio Consumers Council has been heavily involved. In fact, it was their public records request that got us a lot of the texts and a lot of the emails that we've seen, including the one that a lot of people have seen with the First Energy faces on Mount Rushmore, that implied that they were the only people that counted. And so the Consumers Council has been heavily involved, but again, operating at much less strength than it used to operate.
Thank you, Karen. All right, let's move on to Attorney General Dave Yost, who says the case against 8 police officers involved in the shooting death of Jaylen Walker could be presented to a grand jury in early April, nearly 9 months after the 25-year-old Akron man's death. Yost spoke to the Beacon Journal this week about the investigation. Walker died in June after being hit or grazed by 46 shots fired by police. Walker, who was unarmed at the time that he was shot, he had a gun in the car that he had fled, was unarmed when officers fired and shot at him. Yost told the Beacon Journal that the State's Bureau of Investigation is still piecing together hours of footage from officers' body cameras. We've seen a small portion of that, apparently, as it was released to the public. BCI will turn the case over to special prosecutors when completed. Gabe, if Yost's timeline holds up, it'll be nearly a year after the shooting before a grand jury makes a decision on the case. Yost says while speed is important, he doesn't want to cut corners.
Right. And he said he wants to be thorough. And he said that this particular case is complicated. There's a lot of aspects to it. He said that, you know, cases like this will often, well, cases will often spend 400 to 500 hours of working on a case. And this one's already crossed the 1,000 hour mark. And if you think about it, 8 police officers involved in the chase, that's body cameras on each officer. You know, there's a lot more things perhaps to review. So, you know, being thorough is probably going to take a lot of time.
We've seen a lot of change in Akron since then, the Police Review Commission, a civilian oversight board. There's been a lot of activity and activism in Akron as a result of this. What is the thought about the length that it's taking? Has there been any that it has taken? Has there been any reaction from family or supporters of change?
Well, I think certainly it's easy for people to this situation was very public. I mean, there was a lot of protests after the fact, and you know, it's coming at a time where people are really starting to pay attention to police brutality much closer. And I certainly there are going to be people who are wondering, is this getting neglected? Is this being overlooked? And you know, I hope that you know there's a connection between those concerns and the people who are working on this that is not being overlooked. It actually is, you know, a thorough process, which is why I think, you know, Yost decided he needed to say such a thing. So, you know, certainly people want action taken and want to see that, you know, the right decisions are taken care of for family on every side.
Let's move to Central Ohio. A group of parents filed a federal lawsuit against the Hilliard School District near Columbus this week. They claim teachers are discussing LGBTQ topics with students without parental consent, including gender identity and sexual orientation with children as young as six. They also object to teachers wearing badges that support LGBTQ students, basically saying, hey, this is a safe space. You can talk to me. The district has not commented on the lawsuit. Ken, what's going on?
And the district did just comment on the lawsuit,
okay.
So we're going to get to that in a second. So this is a group of parents. These are not random parents. We should highlight from the start that one of the parents actually has testified several times on the State House floor in Columbus for the SAFE Act, the bill that would ban gender-affirming care in the state of Ohio. So these a lot of these eight parents are well-known actors in the scene of trying to deny LGBTQ equality in the state of Ohio. These parents are seeking primarily two things. They want the district, the Hilliard School District, to clarify their policy on outing. What the parents are saying is that if a student shares their sexual orientation or gender identity with any member of the school staff, be it teacher, school counselor, school nurse, anyone, that the school should automatically inform parents that that has been shared. They say that that is an issue of mental health and the parents should be kept in the know. Teacher organizations, teacher unions, certainly school counselor unions, social work unions who say it's against their code of conduct to share information like that say, no, that is not an automatic sharing. That would be outing and it's not healthy for the student. Ironic that what's trying to be protected here is mental health. So that's the number one thing they want. The other thing they want is for the school to ban these badges. So these badges say, I'm here, the words I'm here with a rainbow flag on the front. And they signal that this is a teacher who has resources, who can be supportive of the LGBTQ community. Their objection, these eight parents, on the back of the badge, there's a QR code that links to different resources for teachers who wear this badge. And they say, the parents say that one of the links there links to pornographic material. Now, the superintendent has now in the past 24 hours issued a statement refuting so many of these claims, chiefly that those QR codes aren't visible to any students. So the parents have said, well, students could scan the QR code and get access to pornographic material. And the superintendent has said that part doesn't face, and it doesn't. It doesn't face outward to the students. Mm. So he went point by point through. The Hilliard School District will most certainly be filing a response to this lawsuit.
All right, let's talk about the issue of the outing, because I want to walk through.
Please.
This. If you are a parent, I put myself in this position. If my child is telling a teacher about sexual orientation or gender identity, and I'm clueless, which I would hope I would not be clueless, I would want to know so that I could give the support and the affirmation to help my child. So I would maybe be on the side that says, yes, tell me. Mm-hmm. But I can imagine that you might tell parents who then would try to, you know, reorient their children or have some sort of punitive effect, which is the bad side of that. But what about the idea of sharing with parents, and do parents have a right to know that information, especially to use it in a good situation.
Sure. So what's being conflated here is the idea that parents are not being told automatically that of a student's sexual orientation or gender identity, and the idea that these, and this is one of the quotes from the lawsuit over and over, that these activist teachers are actively keeping parents out of the mix. Those two have been conflated together. And what gets confusing here is that it conveys the idea that teachers are saying, and don't tell your parents. And that's not actually what's happening. These are students who are going to teachers and share. If I can speak from the eye, the first person I came out to was a teacher before I came out to my parents. Hmm. My parents ended up being amazing, but I didn't feel that safety yet. And so many students experience that regardless of how parents actually respond. They want to almost, it's like a pilot program. You want to come out to someone who you trust first, who is not in that parental role. So what the lawsuit is alleging is that teachers are keeping this from parents. And that's not necessarily the case. Many teachers are saying to students, well, what might it look like if you shared this information from your parents? Now, key piece of this lawsuit is that part of the rationale that they are citing, these parents, for why they are justified in this lawsuit is that anti-LGBTQ sweeping resolution that was passed by the State Board of Education in December. When that was passed, I spoke to many lawmakers in the state, including State Senator Nikki Antonio, who was one of many who said, it's a resolution. It doesn't have any teeth to it. And while that may be the case, we are now seeing that and you can't see me doing air quotes, toothless resolution being used as a rationale for lawsuits moving forward from parents. So regardless if that resolution doesn't have the force of law, it is certainly inspiring parents to take action.
And State Senator Nikki Antonio being, I think, the first out politician in the State House.
First out and only currently.
Karen, when we've been talking about this, this mirrors a lot of the discussion, and Ken mentioned some of it, that's been happening in the legislature in terms of legislation that restricts parents restricts teachers or involves parents. This is something that the legislature has been talking about. Will it continue to?
Well, I think that's where the whole debate over the role that potentially super minority Democrats could play here. Because if indeed their support to Speaker Jason Stevens really was part of this whole idea of that they didn't want to see certain pieces of legislation or they wanted to work with him on certain pieces of legislation, this could potentially be one of those kind of things. I mean, you saw in Lame Duck where there was a trans athlete's bill that was added into another bill and that didn't pass. So I would expect that some of these things will come forward again because we've had two sessions where a bill to ban trans athletes from competing in girls' sports has come up and has not gone forward. I wouldn't be surprised to see it again.
And we know that right now, Representative Jenna Powell is passing around to her fellow lawmakers to get co-sponsors to reintroduce banning trans youth from sports. So we know that one's coming up.
And that's certainly something that I think that the folks in the Marin caucus have been supportive of. They're, a lot of those lawmakers are more conservative, and that's the kind of thing that certainly the groups like the Center for Christian Virtue, that's one of the things that they've wanted to see, and they're certainly behind the Marin caucus.
As that involves a school issue, I just want to point out one other one locally before we move on. We're going to take a break and then come back and talk about other news of the week. But the Board of Education in Streetsboro voted last week to allow staff to carry guns in school. Superintendent just talked today, and Connor Morris has updated his story to say that involves non-teaching staff, but that those folks would be able to carry guns if they have the correct qualifications, which in Ohio now requires 24 hours of training, down from what was 700 hours due to a bill passed by state lawmakers and signed by Governor Mike DeWine last year. Thoughts about that? The question is, and what the thing the board said, Ken, specifically, and you're a professor of education, so I want to go to you on this, is that this will make teachers and staff and students more safe. Is there evidence of that?
There isn't. And I think Connor Morris's piece closes with that the research is just not there yet. This is predicated on this will increase school safety. And the research doesn't indicate that yet because there isn't really any research on that yet.
All right, we're going to take a quick break right here, and when we come back, we'll continue to talk about some news, local and state, and we're also going to talk a little bit about movie theaters. Do you still go to the movies? Is that a thing of the past? Three movie theaters have shuttered or will be shuttering in Northeast Ohio. What does that mean about the way we access entertainment? It's the Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable. I'm Mike McIntyre. Stay tuned. You are back with the Sound of Ideas Reporters Roundtable. I'm Mike McIntyre. Thanks so much for staying with us. We also have Ken Schneck and Gabe Kramer and Karen Kassler with us to round out our conversation. The Ohio High School Athletic Association is partnering with Esports Ohio to promote the organization's upcoming tournament. Esports provides competition involving video games, and 250 schools have esports teams. The state tournament is set for the end of May at the University of Akron. Gabe, it's interesting because we're talking about the Athletic Association and esports, yes. And I can just hear people my age and older just cranking, you know, that's not sports, they're not athletes.
Well, okay, so perhaps maybe esports is not the most athletic thing in the world, but it is absolutely a very serious competition, similar to you would find, you know, in other sports. And it's not just competition, it's a form of entertainment for people who want to watch competitions, right? And it's growing so much to the point that there are high school teams, college teams. I've got a good buddy, Aaron Jaggers, who's a regular listener to the Sound of Ideas.
Hey,
but he moved from Shaker Heights to San Antonio because he got a job working at a university there as an esports coach. He was the head esports coach at Shaker Heights High School. So, you know, this is like not only create opportunities for young people to be competitors, but for my buddies to get jobs.
Yeah, somebody, like I said, my age in my 50s, I became aware of this, I don't know, about 5 years ago, that esports was like a huge thing.
Yeah,
like
huge.
I thought it was, you know, you always say it's all these kids are playing video games, but no, there are coaches, there
right.
are teams, there are college teams, there are high school teams.
Baldwin Wallace has a whole esports team. My niece is an extraordinarily competitive gamer and in esports, and it's fascinating just watching how much sexism she encounters being a young female involved in esports.
It's an interesting thing to see that the Ohio High School Athletic Association is now getting in line with that, and it might just show you a little bit of the future, where interests lie and what the future might be for competition.
And you bring up a point here, Ken, that it makes me think, okay, the conversation about, you know, all genders competing, you know, in esports, all genders compete in the same thing, right? There shouldn't be any divide for sure in that. And I just crossed my mind now that you brought it up.
And no concussions.
None that we know of yet. Although I bet you there's some that are documented.
Me and my brother playing video games as kids would knock each other's heads around.
Okay.
Things didn't go our way.
All right. An election reform law enacted earlier this month in Ohio could disenfranchise voters, including transgender people, critics say. The American Civil Liberties Union and of Ohio told WKYC-TV that roughly 1 million Ohioans will be unable to cast ballots due to the changes made by lawmakers. Among the many changes is the requirement that voters casting in-person ballots have a photo ID. What if that doesn't match with someone's gender identity, Ken?
Yeah, that's a big deal. So the legal name change process is H.L. Camerato, a staff writer for the Buckeye Flame, did a great piece on this called Voting While Trans in Ohio. And again, because the legal name change process is lengthy and expensive, many trans and non-conforming people use names that don't match their government records. And we are seeing some issues right now with people getting getting their documentation changed. I should also say that Professor Tom Sutton, a frequent guest here at IdeaStream, clued me into that one of the other issues with this voter registration and voter ID laws is that college students are going to increasingly have a hard time voting where they are attending school if that is not their home state. And colleges are so involved in doing voter registration drives, and that's going to become really complicated if the students who are coming to our colleges from out of state cannot vote in the state where they are residing.
One other thing in the voting reform bill that we hadn't really talked about and hasn't gotten a whole lot of light, Gabe, is the idea that someone who would be identified on their license as a non-citizen or on their state ID. Now, there are people who are non-citizens. They have licenses. What's the criticism or the concerns about having that listed on your driver's license?
Well, I think there have been several moments in history where particular groups have been forced to have some kind of identification on them, be it a tattoo or a scarlet letter or whatever it may be, to identify that this is someone who is different. This is someone who is apparently a non-citizen. And when you, you know, go out of your way to intentionally describe a person as a non-citizen, you know, what you're doing is you're subjecting them to potential harm, to potential harassment, potential racism. You know, people of color in this country, particularly and especially immigrants to this country, are often subject to those things. And when you really want to point it out, it's going to put people kind of on in a spotlight that they perhaps don't want to be in. So I think, you know, what you're really doing is potentially causing harm to people who will be subject to racism and potentially harassed by law enforcement or worse.
And Karen, what we hear from the governor's office is, hey, this is going to help non-citizens because it will help them from inadvertently casting a ballot when they're not allowed to. So that would be a protection for them. Although it seems like that's a real rarity in Ohio.
Yeah. Yeah, the right.
There you are.
Pressing all the right buttons. Yes, as a matter of fact, it is very rare. Secretary of State Frank LaRose has his office tracks this kind of stuff and has mentioned, I mean, we're talking about the low, low double digits, maybe even single digits of cases that have been referred for prosecution. And part of the problem sometimes is that when people go and register their cars or get their driver's licenses, they're offered the opportunity to register to vote. And if you don't know that you can't vote if you're not a citizen, then you might just do that not knowing. And so the question becomes then, is this a criminal act or is this something that maybe needs to be clarified a little bit better? And certainly voting rights advocates have said that this is a problem in search of a problem in a way.
That's exactly what I was going to say. And who's paying the price? Transgender folk and people of color.
All within a climate where voter turnout is abysmal. And so all within this climate where we're trying to say we need to get more people to the polls and we're introducing voter ID laws that are going to decrease those numbers.
Let's hit another news story before we talk about movie theaters. Cleveland Clinic, after a record year financially in 2021, lost more than $200 million last year, according to CEO Dr. Tom Mihaljevic. He said that in his State of the Clinic address this week. Mihaljevic says inflation, healthcare services put on hold by the pandemic, labor shortages and higher wages and other manpower costs led to the shortfall. Gabe, Dr. Mihaljevic struck an upbeat tone, but one theme was clear. The post-pandemic era we're entering will hold challenges for the healthcare industry.
The cost of business is doing up, the cost of energy, cost of supplies, cost of medicine, but labor costs are really the biggest thing that's going up.
And Ken, it's not just the clinic. It's a rough year for hospitals in general.
All over the place. You're seeing closures of various different services and clinics, and the worker shortage is still hurting people enormously.
Also, the clinic began demolition this week on the former Cleveland Playhouse site on Euclid in the Midtown neighborhood. The clinic purchased property in 2009, announced last year it would tear the complex down to make way for construction of a new neurology institute. Ken, it's one of those things where you look at it and it's sad because you remember the history of it. Preservationists particularly fought to save it, given the Playhouse's historical claims, including as the nation's first regional theater. I think anytime something like that comes down, it's sad even for the folks who aren't closely involved.
Yeah, I didn't live here when it was an active site. And so to be able to go through social media and see people's remembrances and old pictures and how that building played such an important backdrop for these pivotal moments in their life, for folks like me who didn't access that site in any meaningful way, it's been quite beautiful to see. But as you said, it's pretty sad.
Yeah, it'll be more of the expansion of the clinic, and I don't think anyone begrudges that. It's the biggest employer in Cleveland, but sometimes when that happens, you lose gems.
Exactly, yeah.
Let's talk about movie theaters. We got a few minutes left in the program. It's been a tough week for big screen lovers in Northeast Ohio, where a string of closings means fewer options for those who want to actually go out and see movies in a theater. AMC announced it was permanently closing the Solon 16 Multiplex. Yesterday came word that Regal will shutter 39 theaters nationwide, including the Regal Montrose Theater in Copley Township. And that's where LeBron James was, I think, when they had the debut of the movie Trainwreck. And this weekend, Cleveland Cinemas will close its Chagrin location, ending with a throwback finale weekend of blockbusters such as Jurassic Park and Back to the Future, in addition to current film offerings. Me, personally, I want to fire up the flux capacitor, set the DeLorean to 1976 at the Detroit Theater in Lakewood, where we kids jumped up and shadowboxed that the Italian Stallion took on Master of Disaster and Rocky. That was a memory. And I wonder if people are going to get memories now. The movie theater industry is struggling to rebound from the pandemic, which shut down theaters and helped shift viewing habits from in-person to streaming options at home, where big screens, once the purview of just the wealthy. I remember some of my rich kid friends who all had those big screen TVs. Now everyone, it seems, they're much more common, much more accessible. So let's talk about that. Are we seeing a sea change and a shift? Ken, do you go to the movies?
I do. I really make a point of supporting the Capitol Theater. It's the only movie theater on the West Side. It's walkable from my house. But other than that, I don't go as much, except for a bit. I'm a Marvel devotee, so give me a big Marvel movie, and I will be there every single time. And I would rather watch it with a group of folks than sit alone.
It's interesting. Based on the kind of movie, Gabe, I think the last one I saw in a theater was the Top Gun remake because it was going to be amazing in terms of the visuals and stuff. But many others, it seems much more convenient to sit in your chair, watch it at home later, or in your case, because people who are younger than me know how to get things immediately, just kind of somehow pirate it.
I can say, and you know, I don't want to take away from the fact that, you know, certainly movie theaters closing has an impact on a lot of people, one for entertainment, but two for economic reasons. For me, I've gone to a movie theater in the last 10 years. I can count on both hands the amount of times that's happened. I mean, it's very few. I'm not a big movie theater person.
Did it not help that they put in these reclining chairs and a lot more space?
Honestly, I didn't know about that until much after it happened because I'm not a frequent goer. It's kind of costly to go to the movie theater. If I'm being honest, and maybe this is a me thing, I'm not a huge movie watcher. And my habit of being addicted to YouTube specifically, but like streamed videos on in short form formats. When the pandemic started, that habit only got worse. So
attention span is an issue then.
That's
too.
A real issue.
Yeah,
sitting
absolutely.
There and now lately, by the way, there have been these 3-hour movies. It's like, does anyone know how to cut film anymore or whatever?
Well, 3.5 hours because it's a good half an hour of commercials and previews.
Wow. Yeah. Good point. Karen, what about you? Are you heading out to whatever theater there is in Columbus in the 10 seconds we have left to talk about it?
I have a 17-year-old son, and Marvel movies are big, so what do you think?
So yes for that, but in
yes,
general?
Indeed. Yeah. I mean, I love the movie theater experience, especially like you were talking about the chairs and just it's great. And to pick your own seat, now you can do that. You don't have to fight with other people for the seats that you want. I really like the movie theater experience. It is expensive. I will give you that.
Right.
You know, movie theater popcorn's the best.
So yes. That's right. It tastes different when it's in the movie theater.
You bet.
And when you pick it up off the floor. No, you don't do
Ew.
That. All right. To get the last word on today's topic, send an email, SOI at ideastream.org. We're on Twitter at Sound of Ideas. Thank you, all of you, for being with us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike.
All right. Happy Lunar New Year.
I'm Mike McIntyre. Thanks so much for listening. And stay safe.